Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Kenneth. Good evening, everybody. It's good to see y'all. Hope y'all are having a good Lord's Day. Tonight, we are going into our next chapter of our story, Creation of the Kingdom. But before we get into that, let's recap where we've been. Now, here's one of the things that I always tell students in my classes, that if you're learning something, that if you can tell what it is you're learning in like a bedtime story to a five-year-old, then you're accomplishing something. You're learning something. And the reason why is if you're able to take complex material and boil it down to some essentials to be able to convey that to a small child, it shows that you're understanding those concepts, right? To take that and to express it in a simpler way. And so as we've talked about the story, again, think about a story of, you know, how you could almost tell it as a bedtime story. And we've the nice alliteration, everything starting with C, the way that they put this together, creation and crisis. That's what we talked about, Genesis 1 through 12. And then we talked about covenant, right? The call of Abram and the story of Abraham and the promise that God makes to this family. Then we talked about calling out, and that was the story of the Exodus and Moses leading the Israelites out of captivity. Then said commandments. This is another covenant, the Mosaic covenant, that is given on Mount Sinai from God to Abraham, to Moses and the people, of if God is going to be in your presence, right, here's how you ought to live. And then the conquest, right, Joshua, the good news of Joshua going in and taking the promised land. But then the second half of that, the bad news that we had last week, was the story of Judges. The Canaanization, how by the end they look just like the people that they were removing. And so tonight we want to talk about the creation of the kingdom and some nobodies and some somebodies. And as we see, the nobodies usually fare better than the somebodies. But tonight we're going to take a look at five major characters. So I'm going to do better this week. I'm going to end on time. I was ending on 5:45, but I realized I need to save a few minutes for our song and closing prayer, so I'll stick with it. I figure about 5 minutes on each person. So again, we're just hitting the highlights here. But as a kind of warm-up, I want you to look at the list of here, the five major characters, and take just a minute and talk with your neighbor. Pick one of those, whichever one you want, and what comes to mind when you think about that person. So go for it. Ruth, Samuel, Saul, David, or Solomon. Pick one. What are some of the first things that come to mind? Our viewers at home, hopefully you have somebody there with you as well, talking about this. And let's see if those things that came up are things that we hit. Obviously, we can't hit everything about these characters, but I imagine that a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about tonight are those things that come to mind. But what I want to do tonight is we're looking at so much in a small amount of time, but again, to see that the big picture, that big picture flow as we're transitioning to a kingdom. And so let's start with Ruth. So Ruth is a Moabite who marries a son of Elimelech. All right, so this is Naomi, is her mother-in-law. And this is during the time of the judges. So that's how the book starts out. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. So this family leaves and goes to Moab. And so Ruth is one of the daughter-in-laws. And all three men die. And so Naomi decides to return to Israel, but Ruth, her daughter-in-law, determines to go with her. And this is, of course, this famous line that we know here, Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. So as Naomi encourages her to go back, just like her sister-in-law, go back to, you know, your people, where you came from, she says, no, I'm going to come with you. And she goes with Naomi. And so what ends up happening is that once they're back in the Promised Land, the book of Ruth, which is just four chapters, you can read it in 5 minutes, it takes on kind of a boy meets girl, a little bit of a romantic twist here. And Ruth meets a faithful to God man named Boaz. Now, who is Boaz? Have you thought about this before? Somebody had mentioned it to me as we were talking about these different characters. Notice that Boaz is the son of Rahab, who we talked about last week. Okay? So think about how Ruth has Naomi as a mother-in-law, with Boaz's mother, Rahab. And so Boaz is kin to her dead father-in-law. And what ends up happening, long story short, and again, we're skipping over all the details because we're covering five characters tonight, but they marry and they have a baby boy named Obed. And Obed is going to be the father of Jesse, and Jesse will have David, okay? So Obed, their son, is the grandfather of David. And so the book of Ruth serves as a kind of introduction to David. And it's interesting, too, that they leave, they go to Moab, and when they come back, there are blessings to be had, and it has a very happy ending. So that's Ruth. I told you we're going to move quick. Let's go to Samuel. So 1 and 2 Samuel, the main characters are Samuel, Saul, and David. And Samuel is going to play this kind of transitionary, introductory role. And King Saul is going to be the first king. And then, of course, David is going to come after Saul. And so we're going to see in 1 and 2 Samuel, as these stories play out, that Samuel plays this important role. And Saul is a kind of foil to the story, like a foil to David, kind of meaning opposite, kind of the good things we see in David are kind of contrasted with those negative, bad qualities that we see in Saul. And David is going to be, you know, the real hero of this part of the story. And so again, the book of Judges provides the background setting of the opening chapters of 1 Samuel. Things are bad. The tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant are at a city named Shiloh. And there's an old man, Eli, who serves as high priest. And he has two corrupt sons. They're really terrible, and you can read a little bit about them. And they're perverting the worship of God. But there's this humble, faithful woman named Hannah. And Hannah prays to God and, of course, gives birth to Samuel. And this gives rise to Samuel eventually becoming priest. So Samuel functions as this final judge, also a priest and a prophet. He's going to anoint the first two kings of Israel. Now, what's going to happen, though, is that Samuel is going to kind of see this transition from the judges to a monarchy. And the Israelites demand that Samuel give them a king so that it can be like everybody else. Let's take a look at this in 1 Samuel chapter 8. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. But his sons weren't the best either, in verse 3 of chapter 8. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. So in verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." So notice here that why is this request for a king so displeasing? Well, a couple things, because they want to be like everybody else around them. Everybody else has a king, so So we want one too.
It's also a sign of a lack
of trust in God. But God tells Samuel to go ahead. And so even though God is not impressed with the people's motives, he is intent on using the Israelite monarchy to bring about his purposes.
And he's going to point, ultimately, to the kingdom of God.
Because eventually, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, will come and reign as the ultimate king, the King of Kings. And that's going to bring God's plan to final consummation.
So here's the thing, as we see these covenants, right? We see the covenant with Abraham, we see the Mosaic covenant, and we're going to see the Davidic covenant, the covenant that God is going to make with David here, which we'll get to in just a bit. All right, so the people, they want a king who can lead them into battle, and they want to be like everybody else, and so God selects Saul as the first king, and it's a man who fits their criteria. This guy is the most handsome and the tallest of all the people. So Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else. So Saul looked the part, for sure. And we see that God grants him success. He's basically setting him up for success. I have here three: the empowering spirit, a great initial military victory, wisdom, advice, and support of Samuel, right? He's got a great advisor in Samuel. And so you see how this plays out in 1 Samuel 10. When he and his servants arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him. The Spirit of God came powerfully upon him, and he joined in their prophesying. Or this great victory that basically he's going to help out some of his fellow people. When Saul mustered them at Bezek, the men of Israel numbered 300,000, and those of Judah 30,000. They told the messengers who had come, "Say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, by the time the sun is hot tomorrow, you will be rescued." And when the messengers went and reported this to the men of Jabesh, they were elated. They said to the Ammonites, "Tomorrow we will surrender to you, and you can do to us whatever you like." The next day, Saul separated his men into three divisions. During the last watch of the night, they broke into the camp of the Ammonites and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. So, right, they wanted a king to fight in the battles. Well, he gives them great success. He gives them this great spirit, this great initial victory. And then again, he has Samuel. And Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and there renew the kingship." So all the people went to Gilgal and made Saul king in the presence of the Lord. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. So things are off to a good start. This is the guy that looks the part. He's handsome. He's tall. God sets him up for success. But we see later, he's going to say, because you were little in your own eyes, there's maybe some self-esteem issues there, and he can't follow through on God. He fears the people more than God. He wants to satiate or make the people satisfied more than God. And so he makes a couple of boneheaded mistakes. For example, in 1 Samuel chapter 13, he grows impatient, waiting for Samuel to come and make a sacrifice. That was Samuel's role. That was his job to do. But instead, he's impatient, and so he just goes ahead and does it himself. He chooses to do that. And that's in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel. And it said in verse 9, "So Saul said, 'Bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings.' And he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. Samuel said, 'What have you done?' And Saul said, 'When I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, "Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought out the favor of the Lord." So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God, with which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart.'" So again, we see, I love the timing there. It's like he finishes it. He just waited a little longer. But notice the people are scattering and he's fearful. And so he takes matters into his own hands. In chapter 14, in the midst of battle, Saul makes a really foolish vow that nobody should eat. Basically, in chapter 14, verse 24, "And the men of Israel had been hard-pressed that day. So Saul had laid an oath on the people, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food until it is evening, and I am avenged on my enemies.'" Well, guess who breaks this? Guess who hasn't heard Saul say this? Jonathan, his son. And so you see in verse 27, "But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath." So he put out the tip of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. And then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. And then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See how my eyes have become bright because I tasted a little of this honey? How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies that they found? For now the defeat among the Philistines has not been great." And so what ends up happening is Saul finds out about it. And he's like, "Ah, Jonathan." And the people basically stand up for him and don't let him follow through on it. Basically, fulfilling this vow would have led to the death of his son. So that's his second bonehead mistake. And the third one, in 15, and I incorporate this a little while back, I think at the beginning of the semester, in a sermon. And so this is a great story, but again, we'll just kind of breeze right past it. But we see in 1 Samuel chapter 15 that Saul directly disobeys God's command to destroy the Amalekites. And for God, that's the last straw. And so we see in 1 Samuel chapter 15, 26, "You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you over king of Israel." And so we see that the next person to come is going to be David. As he said, he's going to seek after someone after God's own heart. Well, David is going to be the second king of Israel. And this time, instead of the people and getting the right person that's going to, you know, look the part and deliver them, God selects the primary criteria. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 7, we see he tells Samuel, "Do not look on his outward, on his appearance, or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." And so ultimately in this process, we see that David is going to be anointed king. He's the second king of Israel. He's a stark contrast to Saul. And there's going to be some civil war between the house of David and the house of Saul following Saul's eventual demise. And so again, we see the Lord looks at the heart. And so most of the story in 1 Samuel 17 through 31, the second half of 1 Samuel, revolves around David and Saul in this contrast. And Saul's role in the story, like I said, it is more of a kind of, we see he's the bad choices he makes, and then we see it in contrast to the brave and dedicated David. And so Saul is still on the throne with no intention of peacefully handing it over to David. And then, of course, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, that's where we get the famous story of David and Goliath. So we know this story. My three-year-old has been throwing bean bags at a cutout Goliath lately. She brings home slingshots. They're talking about this a lot in Bible class. The story we all know. But again, now, if you know, we look at these stories and we learn some of the basic pieces, and then there's always something more as we come back. And one of the things I think about in David and Goliath is just to remember, who should have stood up to Goliath? Remember when the Israelites, they wanted a king, somebody who's going to fight their battles? So Saul should be the one that's standing up to Goliath. And I mean, he's the tallest in the whole country. And yet he's scared, and so it's going to be this little shepherd boy that's going to come and deliver. And so, again, we see this fight that should have been conducted by Saul. I mean, he's the king. He's the largest and the best armored of the Israelites. David even tries to put on the armor, right, and he can't do it. And he's like, "No, don't worry about it. I don't need any armor." All right, and so what we see here is that after David's victory, Saul becomes jealous of him. Remember, he's little in his own eyes, some of that stuff. And you see David come along and all the things that he's doing, and he attempts to kill David several times. And when David is given the chance to kill Saul, he spares his life, even though his men are like prodding him, like, "Now's your chance." He says, "No, because God's anointed, I'm not going to do that." And that's where he cuts off a little part of his clothing and kind of says, "I could have killed you, but I didn't." So Saul slowly kind of loses his sanity, and at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 31, Saul is killed in battle with the Philistines. And what ends up happening then is in 2 Samuel, we see that 2 Samuel chapter 5, David is going to be confirmed as king by the entire nation. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you," notice that, right? Saul was king, but you were the one leading the campaigns, right? That was the role of what the king was supposed to be doing. But anyways, "And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.' When all the elders of Israel had come to King David, the king made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. So it gives you an idea here, coming to power at the age of 30. All right, so David's reign, man, it starts off, it's just, you know, just everything's going right. Everything's going well. That we see that he has great success, that he conquers the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites, and he establishes the capital there. And then David is going to defeat the Philistines, and he finally drives them out from the country. And then in 2 Samuel chapter 6, David brings the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, and it returns it to the center of Israel's national worship. And this is where we get to in chapter 7, this significant covenant that God makes with David. Notice chapter 7. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 7. We'll park there for just a minute because this is such a crucial, important point in the story. Now, when the king lived in his house and the Lord had given him rest from all his surrounding enemies, the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells in a tent." And Nathan said to the king, "Go, do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you." But that same night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan, "Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, would you build me a house to dwell in? I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. In all places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, so they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." In accordance with all these words, in accordance with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. And so we see here that God promises that a descendant of David will be established on the throne of a kingdom that will last forever. And later in the Old Testament, the prophets are going to take this covenant promise with the hope of a future Messiah. And so they're identifying the coming Messiah as a descendant of David. So why does Matthew start out with a genealogy? Right, you go and you're like, I'm going to go to the first page of the New Testament and I'm going to read it all. And you go and your eyes maybe start to glaze in chapter 1 of Matthew. This is all these names and genealogy. See, to us as a reader today, that might be kind of boring, right? But this was so important. Why does Matthew start out that way? Because he's writing from it to a Jewish audience and he's trying to show this is so important, what you've been looking for, right? The Gospel of Matthew has all these fulfillment formulas, like, this happens so it may be fulfilled. This happens so it may be fulfilled. So this becomes a major expectation for the Messiah. So what we see is that David wants to build God a house, a temple, but God says he will build David a house. And so this is an incredibly significant moment. And so David has great success as king. He unifies Israel, he establishes the capital, he brings the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem, he reinstitutes a worship of God there. But then what we see is the story has a pivot point, a turning point. And this is where we see that David is a great man, but he is not a Messiah. And he's merely a man. And in 2 Samuel 11, it all comes crashing down. David, our hero, sends his army off to war. And you see from the way it starts, 2 Samuel chapter 11, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. And the king should have been out in the battle. He's back there. And of course, we know the story of Bathsheba. He takes another man's wife, sleeps with her. She becomes pregnant. To try to cover up his sin, he ends up having him, her husband, murdered. Puts him on the front line and draw your troops back. So David sets it up so that he is killed. And so this is where we see that everything going up into this was going great, and we're going to see the aftermath in the rest of 2 Samuel. And so what ends up happening in 2 Samuel chapter 12, God sends the prophet Nathan to confront David about his sin. Right? And so Nathan gives this little story, right? This little, analogy. And David's like, that person should die. And then Nathan says, right, this is where, like, the King James is the better version, right? Thou art the man. ESV says, you are the man. But I like that, thou. Thou art the man, right? It's you. And so he confronts David with his sin. But David, he does repent, and he does, return to God, but there's consequences for his actions. And so what we see is that everything starts to go bad, and the rest of 2 Samuel chronicles David's struggles and the problems from that. In the last four chapters of 2 Samuel, 21 through 24, it summarizes David's reign, including the good and the bad. But the book ends with a positive forward look as David dedicates an altar on the site of the future temple. And the one who's going to build the temple is going to be Solomon. So this brings us to our fifth character. We talked about Ruth. We talked about Samuel. We talked about Saul. We talked about David. And let's wrap up with Solomon tonight. So the books of 1 and 2 Kings follows right after 2 Samuel. And David is old and he's about to die. And although he's had several wives and numerous sons, he follows through after the prodding of Bathsheba, and he appoints her son Solomon as the next king. And so here we see in the case of Saul and David, the selection had been done by God, but here, as David chooses a successor, God is silent. And David warns Solomon to obey God. In 1 Kings, notice this, because, man, this Solomon has warning after warning from David and from God. Notice in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 2, right, this is like on his deathbed to Solomon. He says, I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, his testimonies, that is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. That's what David leaves him with. And on the surface, Solomon's reign seems to be going well. We see that David has tried to warn him, but if you read between the lines, we see that he fails to follow through on some things. Again, on the surface, he forms important alliances, he marries the daughter of foreign kings, he consolidates and expands the kingdom, and God blesses him with wisdom and great wealth, and he builds up Jerusalem, he builds a grand palace. It takes him 7 years to build the temple, and then the next line it says, if you read it, it says just kind of a statement of fact, but I wonder if there's something there. He spent 7 years on the temple and then 13 years on his house. So, anyways, he's building up Jerusalem, he's building up the temple, he's building up a grand palace, right? And most importantly, he's constructing that temple for God, and he places the ark inside the temple in the most holy place. He builds a huge standing army with a large number of chariots, a fleet of ships to sail. But again, if we go back to Deuteronomy, there are warnings for the future kings of Israel. Do not accumulate large numbers of horses, especially from Egypt. Do not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold, and do not take many wives. And what do we see? He accumulates over 12,000 chariot horses. He accumulates large amounts of silver and gold. He takes over 700 wives and 300 concubines. And the cherry on top marries Pharaoh's daughter. And why were they not to really have anything to do with Egypt? Because they had been enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. And so we see here that there, the implication there is to not have any, serious relationship with Egypt. And so with all this in mind here, we see that it's not as successful as it might appear on the surface.
If we go back, let me see. So in Solomon chapter, in 1 Kings chapter 3, that's where you get that Solomon asks for wisdom. And then we get the famous story about the two prostitutes and the arguing over the child. In chapter 7, he's building his palace. In chapter 9, this is what I was going to point out before I go to this passage. In chapter 9 of 1 Kings, as soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. Now look at this. There's if-then statements. If you do this, then that. It reminds us back in Deuteronomy. If you do this, right? If you follow God, there will be blessings. And if you don't, there will be curses. And so God gives, Solomon got it from David. He gets it twice from God. And notice in verse 4, and as for you, if you walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. And that brings us to here, chapter 11, where we see the end result here. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. And the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, right, as like told you twice, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out in the hand of your son. And so what we see here is that, stated here, that Solomon turned his heart away from God. One of the reasons, you know, to not take many wives or foreign wives, turn their hearts away from God, not to have great armies or silver and gold because you start to trust in yourself. And so we see here that his heart turned after these other gods. And so at this point, the nation of Israel is going to begin this long downward slide into idolatry. And it's going to eventually lead to the end of the kingdom and to the exile. And so again, this is like, what a bummer to end on again, right? You see this pattern. And so a couple things, though, to think about, and I'm about out of time, so we'll save it maybe for next time. But, you know, why would God make this covenant, this Davidic covenant with this king, and knowing that, you know, there's only a handful that are going to be good, but yet we see that God ultimately is going to redeem that through Jesus Christ, that Jesus is King of Kings, kind of pulls the rug out from under it, of this kind of human control to being under Christ. And so David, as we see in the story, he's the Messiah-like king who delivers Israel from the disaster of Judges, but David is just a human being. And he stumbles, and we see the major consequences of his sin, and it leaves us looking forward to the real Messiah. And as Israel fails to keep the Mosaic covenant, she experiences the promised consequences of judgment. These don't come out of anywhere, like they have been warned. But yet, also at the same time, are these promises that God has made to Abraham and to David. And so there's going to be this hope for the future through the coming Messiah. And so again, we're going to be seeing that, understanding all this rich background, it will help us appreciate when we see the arrival of the Messiah and the kingdom of God, and we can make those connections of these promises that have been made. All right, so what I want you to do for 60 seconds, now go back to what we talked about, or we had those characters. In 60 seconds, because we're going to wrap up and then we're going to sing a song. If you haven't had the Lord's Supper, you'll be able to go back when we sing, and Seth will serve you back there. Take 60 seconds. Is there something that stood out to you new tonight? Is there something new that you learned about one of these characters in the story that maybe has slipped past you before? Take a second and talk with your neighbor about that.
All right, so I know tonight there weren't a ton of questions, there weren't any cool videos, and it just me doing a lot of talking, but there was a lot of ground to cover, right? But hopefully as we revisit these stories, and to do so, I know that it's so quick you can hardly get into anything, but at least maybe when we do that, we can kind of zoom out and see some big picture things that maybe we haven't caught before, or to tie together the pieces of those other things that we do know already. So Kyle's going to come and lead us in a song. And then I'll come and dismiss us. And if you need to take a Lord's Supper, we weren't able to this morning, Seth is heading right out in the back there, and you can go there at this time. Kyle?